Sports Network. He's not Rush. He's not Sean. He's Dan. Dan Newman. And as usual, he's got the inside scoop on what's really happening in D.C. and everywhere else in the U.S. and the world. TNN, the Truth News Network. Here's Dan.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Truth News Network today, in which we're going to take a look at the very controversial Electoral College. Should we keep it or should we lose it? You know, no other part of our election system is as important as the Electoral College. No other part of our election system has come under fire through the years since its establishment than the Electoral College. The furor over its existence ebbs and flows through cycles, but in recent presidential elections that were decided by the voting results of the Electoral College, which totals were different than the totals of the American popular vote, have put discussions about ending the Electoral College front and center once again. It is controversial, to be honest. And that controversy, in large part, is the result of American voters not understanding the Electoral College's structure, its purpose, and its controversy. Those Americans that are confused pretty much all subscribe to the thinking, why even have it at all? Especially when in 2000, the Bush 43 election, and then in the 2016 Trump elections, its results, the Electoral College, and ultimately the presidency and vice presidency, were decided by other than popular vote totals of all Americans. So they say, why even have it? So in all the confusion and misunderstanding, we thought it best to look into all the details of the Electoral College so everyone can participate in educated discourse about its value, its history, and its impact on the country going forward, and what might happen if it goes away. So let's take a look, after which in our summary, we will share our conclusions, as we always do. The Electoral College members for each state are voted on by the state's residents on voting day. In some states, the electors' names are printed on the ballots directly below the presidential candidates' names, or they're grouped by party somewhere else on the ballot. In other states, the names of Electoral College nominees are not even listed on the ballot. When you vote for a presidential and vice presidential candidate on your ballot, you are really voting for the electors of the political party, or if it's an unaffiliated candidate, by which they were nominated. Take the North Carolina General Statute 163-209, for example. It says, quote, a vote for the candidates for president and vice president named on the ballot is a vote for the electors. So it's revealed there. This is the case for 48 of our 50 states. It's known as the winner-take-all system, where all electors go with the candidate who wins the popular vote, regardless of how close that vote might be. So if the Democrat candidate narrowly wins the popular vote in Texas, for instance, 38 Democrat electors, 38 being the total number of electoral votes in the state of Texas, will represent Texas as a voting bloc. There's another system. It's known as the congressional district method. It's observed in Maine and Nebraska. In those two states, the vote is split between the electoral vote, which goes to the winner of the statewide popular vote, and the congressional district vote. The state is divided into congressional districts, each with one electoral vote. The winner of the popular vote in each district is awarded one electoral vote, potentially. This could result in a divided electoral vote, but so far, it's not happened in either of those two states. Most of the time, electors cast their votes for the candidate who has received the most votes in the state he or she represents, or for the candidate affiliated with his or her political party. However, there have been times when electors have voted contrary to the people's decision, and when electors cast their vote without following the popular vote or their party line, they are known as faithless electors. In response to faithless electors' actions, at least two dozen states have created laws to enforce an elector's pledge to his or her party vote, or the popular vote, as the case may be in their state. Some states even assess a misdemeanor charge and even a fine. For example, the state of North Carolina fines faithless electors $10,000. However, a number of scholars believe such state-level laws would not survive a constitutional challenge. Of the 158 faithless electors, none have ever been punished. In most presidential elections, the candidate who wins the popular vote will also receive the majority of the electoral votes. But this is not always the case. Some electors abstain from voting, while others vote differently than they pledge to vote. Despite 11th-hour changes within the Electoral College, only five candidates in U.S. history, just five, have won an election by losing the popular vote and winning or deadlocking the elected vote. Let's look back on those real quick. 1824, John Quincy Adams, the son of former President John Adams, received some 38,000 fewer votes than did Andrew Jackson, but neither candidate won a majority of the Electoral College. Adams was awarded the presidency when the election was thrown to the House of Representatives. In 1876, nearly unanimous support from small states gave Rutherford B. Hayes a one-vote margin in the Electoral College, despite the fact that he lost the popular vote to Samuel J. Tilden by over 250,000 votes. Hayes carried five out of the six smallest states, excluding Delaware. These five states, plus Colorado, gave Hayes 22 electoral votes with only 109,000 popular votes. At the time, Colorado had just been admitted to the Union and decided to appoint electors instead of holding elections. So, Hayes won Colorado's three electoral votes with zero popular votes. It was the only time in U.S. history that small state support has decided an election. In 1888, Benjamin Harrison lost the popular vote by 95,713 votes to Grover Cleveland, but he won the electoral vote by 65. In this instance, some say the Electoral College worked the way it is designed to work by preventing a candidate from winning an election based on support from one region of the country. Remember that. Benjamin Harrison, who lost that vote, lost it to Grover Cleveland the first time the election was decided by not allowing the popular vote of one specific region of the country to elect that president. The South overwhelmingly supported Grover Cleveland. He won by more than 425,000 votes in six southern states. However, in the rest of the country, he lost by more than 300,000 votes. That's according to the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration. Then in 2000, how can we forget? Al Gore received 50,992,335 votes nationwide in the popular vote, and George W. Bush received 50,455,156 votes. The race was so close in Florida. You remember that. You remember the furor over all of that down in Florida? That ineffectively punched ballots that are known will always remember their name, Hanging Chads, required a manual recount because the voter intent couldn't be deciphered by their machines. Eventually, Bush was awarded the state of Florida by the U.S. Supreme Court and had a total of 271 electoral votes, which beat Gore's 266 electoral votes. And then, in 2016, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 2.8 million over Donald Trump, the largest margin by a presidential loser in U.S. history. But Trump won 306 electoral votes to Clinton's 232, a dramatic difference there. He won all the Great Lakes states that traditionally vote Democrat, plus four big battleground states that included Florida and Michigan, by less than one percentage point. Clinton had bigger leads and fewer, but more populous states like California and New York. Today, a candidate must receive 270 of the 538 votes in the Electoral College to win the election. In cases where no candidate wins a majority of electoral votes, the decision is thrown to the House of Representatives by virtue of the 12th Amendment. The House then selects the president by majority vote, with each state delegation receiving one vote to cast for the three candidates who receive the most electoral votes. So, who decides in the case of an impasse? When there's an impasse in the Electoral College, the decision goes to the House of Representatives, which has happened twice in U.S. history. In 1801, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, both Democrat Republicans, received the same number of electoral votes, even though Burr was running as a vice presidential candidate. After 36 successive votes in the House, Jefferson was finally elected president. Then in 1825, Andrew Jackson received the popular vote over John Quincy Adams. but neither man received the electoral vote majority to claim the presidency. Adams won the House vote on the first ballot and became president. The Electoral College debate. And here's where it gets dicey. Proponents of the Electoral College say the system serves its purpose, despite the fact that the candidate who wins the popular vote doesn't always win the election. The Electoral College is a block or weighed of voting system designed to give more power to the states with more votes, but allows for small states to swing an election, as happened in 1876, as we mentioned above. Under this system, each state is assigned a specific number of votes proportional to its population so that each state's power is representative of its population. So while winning the popular vote may not ensure a candidate's victory, a candidate must gain popular support of a particular state to win the votes of the electors in that state. The goal of any candidate is to put together the right combination of states to earn those 270 Electoral College votes that wins the presidency. As the 2000 election approached, some observers thought that Bush, the son of former President George H.W. Bush, could win the popular vote, but that his opponent, Al Gore, could win the Electoral College vote because Gore was leading in certain big states such as California, New York, and Pennsylvania. In the end, Gore secured the popular vote, but Bush won by securing the majority of votes in the Electoral College. Since then, a push to reform the Electoral College has been gaining steam. As of December 2016, California, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, and the District of Columbia have passed legislation that mandates electoral votes go to the presidential candidate who wins the national popular vote. In addition, 12 other states have passed a reform bill through one house, but not the other. Still, more states are introducing an Electoral College reform bill or discussing it in committee. This information we just gave you is from the National Popular Vote Law that would take effect only when it's been passed by enough states to have a total number of electoral votes of 270. So, there you have the structure. There you have the reasoning for its structure, and you also have the controversy laid out about the Electoral College. Do we need it, or does it need to go? We'll give our final thoughts, and then we'll let you make your decision right after this from the Truth News Network.
So busy you don't have time for today's news on TV or newspaper? Never fear. TNN has your answer. Download TNN Podcast to your phone. Catch up with the latest news during your busy day. The Truth News Network. TNN. TruthNewsNet.org.
Long live the courageous. May God bless and keep you always. The tenacious. The ones who push forward and give back. Long live the greater good. The helping hand. Those who fall and get back up. And long live the truck with the strength to overcome. The will to outwork. And the commitment to outlast them all. Ram, proven to last.
Hi, Tom Baudet. Of all the things invented in 1962, some have faded away, like cassette tapes. And others are still very much with us, like lava lamps and Motel 6. Yep, Motel 6 is celebrating 50 years of giving travelers a good night's rest and saving you more for what you travel for. But we're just getting started. In fact, the longer you watch us, the better we get. Kind of like a lava lamp. Trippy. I'm Tom Baudet for Motel 6. 50 years and the light's still on.
Getting tired of only spin while looking for just the news? No spin, just truth. Read and hear it every day on TNN, the Truth News Network. TruthNewsNet.org.
Let's be honest about it. We've been discussing the Electoral College and all of its controversy. Details of its purpose, its construction, the reasons for support, and the reasons for change that many in the U.S. hold. But it all boils down to one thing and one thing only. Why was it established way back when? Let's face it, our forefathers were pretty sharp. Most of them, or their parents, escaped oppressive governments in Europe. We got to remember that when we have this conversation. Most of those European governments were dominated by the political processes from large cities like London, Paris, Barcelona, Rome, and even Berlin. Our early settlers have lived in and through a political process with similarities to ours today. Think about it. Domination on the most part by residents, and therefore voters, who live in big cities, regional metropolitan areas of the country, and many of those are coastal. Our forefathers and their families fought the overwhelming political control of folks who lived in those big, large metropolitan areas in Europe that in many ways could not even relate to residents and voters who lived in rural parts of those European countries, called flyover America in today's United States. It wasn't fair in Europe, and our forefathers knew it would not be fair in the U.S. either. The Electoral College was the best solution they could surmise to implement and maintain election fairness for non-metropolitan citizens, those in the 18th century's rural America and today's America's flyover citizens. Of course, those same forefathers included a way for us to change or even cancel the Electoral College with a constitutional amendment to do so. Of course, doing that is difficult, and it takes a long time. And purposely, they made it that way. They knew that using the Constitution as the foundation of our legal structure and requiring its amending to be intricate would prevent politicians from simply making changes willy-nilly, especially based on political perspective. There are two ways to amend it. Method one, let's talk about both. Method one, Congress proposes such an amendment. An amendment to the Constitution may be proposed by any member of the House of Representatives or any member of the Senate and will be considered under the standard legislative process in the form of a joint resolution. In addition, as ensured by the First Amendment, all American citizens are free to petition Congress or their state legislatures to amend the Constitution. Most people don't even realize that. To be approved, an amending resolution must be passed by a two-thirds supermajority vote in both the House and the Senate. Given no official role in the amendment process by Article 5, the President of the United States is not required to sign or otherwise approve the amending resolution. Presidents, however, typically express their opinion of proposed amendments and may attempt to persuade Congress to vote for or against them. And then, if approved by Congress, the proposed amendment is sent to the governors of each of the 50 states for their approval, called ratification. Congress will have specified one of two ways by which the state should consider ratification. Those two ways are, first, the governor submits the amendment to the state legislature for its consideration, or the governor convenes a state ratifying convention. It's up to the governors of each of the 50 states. If the amendment is ratified by 3/4, that would be currently 38 of the state legislatures or those ratifying conventions, it becomes part of the Constitution. Method two, then, the states demand a constitutional convention. Under the second method of amending the Constitution prescribed in Article 5, if 2/3, that's currently 34, of the state legislatures vote to demand it, Congress is required to convene a full constitutional convention. Just as in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, delegates from every state would attend the so-called Article 5 Convention for the purpose of proposing one or more amendments. Though this more momentous method has never been used, the number of states voting to demand a constitutional amending convention has come close to the required 2/3 vote on several occasions. Indeed, the mere threat of being forced to surrender its control of the constitutional amendment process to the states has often prompted Congress to preemptively propose amendments itself. That shouldn't surprise you. We understand and we know well, power is what makes Congress tick. Obviously, either method is tough to do, and purposely so. In most Americans' minds, our hope is that our legislators in Washington simply go to work to resolve even the controversial issues that are those that prompt cries to eliminate the Electoral College. Our concern is that far too many people making those cries do not understand its structure and its purpose, and have simply been told the Electoral College thwarts the will of the majority of the people in the popular vote. No. The Electoral College protects the voices of all Americans who do not live and therefore do not vote in large cities, large metropolitan areas, primarily on the West and the East Coast of the United States. Once again, when understood, the reasoning for the Electoral College becomes crystal clear. And remember this, you hear this all the time from us here at Truth News Network. Just because you think something is wrong doesn't mean it's wrong. And just because you think something is right doesn't mean it's right. It could be wrong and it could be right, regardless of what we individually think about it. Hey, it's a weekend. I thought it'd be a great time to discuss and get the details of how and why the Electoral College functions and why it even exists. It's a very important topic, one that we need to make decisions about, Americans, voters. And to do that, we've got to have the facts. To that end, why don't you share this podcast with some of your friends? You can download it and then email it out. They need to understand, just like you do now, what the Electoral College was formed for, how it was formed, and the good and the possible bad that would occur if a constitutional amendment was created and passed, ratified, to do away with it. You guys have a great weekend. We'll be back first thing next week. Another great story, another investigation from Truth News Network. Until then, so long, everybody.
We don't tell you what to think,
but we give you truth to think about.
This is TNN, the Truth News Network.
TruthNewsNet.org.